Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. For many, Anita Pallenberg was, at various points in her life, a newspaper headline, a rock and roll goddess, a voodoo priestess, and an evil seductress. She was accused of trying to break up the Rolling Stones, among many other things. What is made clear in co-directors Alexis Bloom and Svetlana Sill's compelling documentary film, Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg, as those who loved her consider an exciting cultural force and a loving mother, as well as innocent of all of these accusations. It's a wonderful film, wonderfully done documentary film. It's called Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg, and we're joined today by the co-directors, Alexis Bloom and Svetlana Sill. To both of you, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you both for being here today. I just love this film, and it's such a warm-hearted film, so well told, the story of Anita Pallenberg. Where did the idea for this film come from?
The origin was with Marlon. I mean, credit where credit's due.
Marlon being Marlon Richards, her son.
Yeah. After Anita had passed, it was, I guess it was 2 years after she passed. She passed away in 2017. He found her manuscript, portions of it, of her memoir. It's not a book. It wasn't beginning, middle, end of her life, but it was various chapters, notes, some tapes. And he knew he had the Super 8 millimeter. And at that point, he decided that somebody should make a documentary film about his mum. He and I have some mutual friends, and they very kindly recommended me to him. We started a correspondence. And very soon I brought Svetlana in because Svetlana and I had been working together at Alex Gibney's production company, and I'd always wanted to work with her. So it was sort of, tag teaming.
Before we get too far into this, because for a lot of people, a lot of our listeners won't know who Anita Pallenberg is, was, let's talk about sort of the broad outlines of how we got to know her, her initial sort of introduction into the world of music and fashion and so much more. Let's talk a little bit about her origin story, if you will. Svetlana?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's her origin story. I think you even said it when we first started talking just in this interview that you had known of her, like you had heard of her, you had seen a couple of her films, but you didn't really know that much about her. I think she has more name recognition in the UK than she does in the US, for sure. But I think she's known as probably most widely as being like, you know, Brian Jones's girlfriend. And then she got together with Keith and she dressed really well and she was really pretty and she was an actor and she, you know, she was in the movie Performance and she's in Barbarella. There's sort of these like little flashpoints about her, but not really knowing that much about her personality or her her creativity or her humor, her intellect. And so the fact that Marlon found these pages of her, you know, unpublished drafts towards her memoirs, it really lends itself to getting a more complete picture of a three-dimensional human being, right? She's also known as a kind of muse, which is true. She was very inspiring to the Rolling Stones, to, you know, other people around her, to fashion designers later in her life. But we were able to really get into, you know, who she was as a human being, as a mother, as a sister, as a her own perspective on these times.
Recently, I saw Nick Broomfield's documentary about Brian Jones. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that part of the story of Anita initially coming into sort of the Rolling Stone world, that she was involved with him. That lent a lot of, for me personally, lent a lot of context to what I saw in this film about Brian Jones. But this film is about Anita Pallenberg, and she's such an interesting person, so intellectual in ways that I don't think I would have imagined before I saw this film. I do want to talk about her family background because she seemed reticent to talk about that beyond what we see in the film. So Alexis, what? Let's talk about where she came from, her family.
Yeah, she came from a very cultured family. Her father was sort of a virtuoso classical musician, didn't make a living out of it, but played beautifully. And she had a lot of art. Her grandfather, her uncle was an artist. She just had it in her family and grew up around kind of the high arts, let's call it. So she was very sort of comfortable in that world. She read a lot. She read voraciously. I think she was always encouraged to read. And it was valued in her family. So even though she became proto-punk and an anarchist and kind of a drug addict and a crazy lady adventurer, she continued to read and continued to value the arts. She was great friends with artists. She connected people. You know, she was great friends with the gallerist Robert Fraser. They used to call him Groovy Bob.
Groovy Bob, yeah.
you know, and washed Jasper Johns's brushes in New York. And she's just very comfortable in that world. It's just enviable in that way.
But I think, yeah, she was eager to leave home, though, too. I think she was, you know, she grew up post-war, like just as the war was ending in Rome. And I was, from a young age, very eager to get out and experience a world outside of the one that she grew up in. And she was fascinated by America, by American music. You know, she like learned all the dances. She listened to Fats Domino. She was very eager to get out of sort of old world, old culture, Europe, and land in New York, which, you know, we do cover a bit in the film.
What for me was the key to sort of beginning to unlock some of what she was about was in the film, there's a reference to her being a part of Bohemian aristocracy. And I feel like that's, there's kind of going back to Salvador Dali or Picasso or whatever, in that sort of European tradition of exploring new ways of seeing the world, art, film, so much of that. And so much of that was also, I think, how many of these artists, including the Stones and the Beatles and others that we've grown to, you know, lionize for their work and their vision, came out of surviving World War II. I mean, in the film, it's her first memories. I mean, so I think we, as we sit here today in the generation I grew up with, didn't really understand the impact that it had. And I think it had a tremendous impact on her because we weren't impacted here in the United States. We don't have that same frame of reference. And you see the frame of reference with so many of these different artists that we've come to admire. And I think for me, that's what I got from hearing her story. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very fair. And I think that was a huge, it was something that Anita and Keith really bonded over too, were those experiences of growing up just after the war. And it was incredibly formative. And I think incredibly formative in her own sense of rebellion too. And of, you know, wanting freedom and that kind of being the North Star, like of her existence, was always going forward, always going for the new thing, always, you know, wanting the new experience, was sort of getting away from the trauma of, you know, of post-war Europe.
And Alexis, I'm not sure if this, playing psychiatrist here, pardon me, but I don't know if that doesn't instill in someone a sense of mortality, a sense of this could be over in a second. If bombs are raining down on your town, you've got to think about that would maybe for some to go into a shell and for others to live every day like it's their last.
It's a wonderful, you know, an unexpected byproduct. That sense that the carpet could be pulled from under your feet at any moment.
Yeah.
Certain people of vitality. You see it in countries today, like I'm from Johannesburg, it's like very high crime. And people live like that. You know, when they party hard. In Brazil as well, those sort of places that where there's economic disparity and it's not quite so comfortable and stodgy, you know, people, you know, go it's sort of hell-bent for leather sometimes. Yeah. And that's all right.
Yeah.
She did, you know, she abhorred bourgeois stuff. I talked about her, you know, grounding in all the classics, but she didn't value it. She wanted, as Keith says, kick it all over. She was like, you know, out with the old, in with the new, put up the sails and crack on with the wind. Let's go, you know?
Yeah. But I think that frame of reference, there's a line that we always sort of quote back and forth to each other that's not in the film, but, you know, that is very informative about her childhood, which is a banana was big news.
Yeah.
Like having, you know, she had, someone had given a piece of fruit, a banana, to her as a kid, and she ended up giving it to her sister, right? And it was this, I mean, there's more of a story behind that, but it was like a banana was a big deal,
yeah,
in that time. And you think about that, and you think about that is very informative, you know, as a, that kind of scarcity and the trauma of that, those early days of her childhood, I think is very informative and sort of seizing the moment and the way she chose to live her life.
Yeah. Just want to remind our listeners that we are speaking with the co-directors and co-producers, but terrific film called Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg. And that would be Alexis Bloom and Svetlana Zill. The way in which she was not intimidated by being around the Rolling Stones and these artists and all the, her sort of the world that she traveled in could not have been faked. She felt like she always thought she belonged there, that she was at least as smart as anyone else in the room, that she had a certain dynamic ability not only to attract admirers, but she also knew that she wanted to have agency. She wanted to be thought of as everyone, at least their equal, if not more. And I love that. I just was so drawn to her in what we see in the film. She didn't seem intimidated. She just seemed,
for a lot of, it's very alluring. I mean, I think about that too. It's very, I think there was still vulnerability. I mean, when she moved to New York, she didn't really speak English when she moved to New York, and she was 19, 20, and she was very, very young. So she was in the mix with, you know, Warhol and Ginsberg and Jasper Johns, and she was teaching herself English by reading books at home. Like, that was her. So I think there's a strength and a bravery to her, but she was also a vulnerable person too. I mean, it's not as though, she was totally immune to that kind of vulnerability, but I think she was very strong and brave as well.
And I'm curious how you see how that works in her sexuality, her the allure that she was for so many of these very, very successful artists and such. What we're talking about play into the magnetism that she had?
Well, I think she's a great Democrat, right? You know, so if you start with that, not in as in Democrat, Republican, but like she really spoke to, somebody said she spoke to the Queen the same way as she did to the janitor. And she was an equal opportunities person. She was no bullshit. Everyone's allowed to be wherever they want to be. And that included her, right? So she was like that. And it also included kind of sexual partners. She was like, all right, if you want to fool around, we'll fool around. If you're a man, if you're a woman, if you're, you know, famous, if you're not, she had a lot of lovers.
Yeah.
And they weren't all important. And she, you know, looked at other people the same way too. People always said about her that she had no airs and graces and she wasn't a snob. And she was interested in people who were interesting. And it had nothing to do with money. She was not motivated by money. So, you know, I see her and her sort of being such an omnivore in all spheres of her life through that lens.
The first act, if you will, of her life was becoming well-known for the people that she associated with. She did have other acts to her life. And as you mentioned earlier, her impact on fashion and as she went through her life and as an actress, et cetera, that resiliency is another part of this film that, again, I was just so unfamiliar with, much beyond kind of the tabloid headlines of her. So to see that and to see the complicated relationship she has with her family and children, she seemed to be wanted to be a good mom, right, for sure. Now, it didn't always work that way. So I, again, sort of her resiliency. Let's talk a bit about that as well.
I mean, also the addiction and drug. I mean, I think that's a big part of it too, right? I mean, to think of the resiliency of being able to survive a number of tragedies. The death of her child was, you know, an awful, awful experience. There's a lot of darkness that happens, and then a lot of substances that continue to get used, I think, as an antidote to some of that experience. And she was incredibly resilient. And she, I don't know, it's funny, we talked a lot about in the course of making the film, like, it does get so dark, it's sort of shocking that she ever can emerge out of that and have this second act of her life where she, you know, she is able to get sober eventually, and she returns to acting, and she has this whole other version of her life, and she's still the same person, right? It's not like some integral part of her. There's this spirit and aliveness in her and authenticity in her. And I think a lot of that is this inner strength, and really, you know, she was someone who was motivated by her own curiosity and her own experience of life, and not by some idea of status or career or fame or these external things. And I think that is a big part of her resilience, that and the love of her family. I think, you know, as you said, she, you know, maybe didn't always make the best choices as a mother, but really deeply loved her kids, and they always felt loved by her. And I think she later in life, her kids having kids, becoming a grandmother, experiencing the love of family was also a big part of her resilience.
Yeah, they loved her back.
It's a complex and intimate and, I think, fully formed look at her and her life. And I just came away from it appreciating her, appreciating all the things that she did, and understanding her flaws, and the things that I'm not going to sit in judgment of, the things that she went through. She was a remarkable person, putting everything else aside, smart, resilient, and so much more. The film Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg, is going to be out on May 3rd. And it'll be playing here in Los Angeles at the New Art Theater on May 10th, which is 405 Freeway, Santa Monica Boulevard. You can't miss it. You literally can't miss it. So, well, I want to thank both of you so very much, because you made my, this is so good. It's such a good, that's the other part. I really want to in closing, I want to talk about just what a wonderfully put together film this is. It really, really, truly, really, I mean, honestly, just unfolds in such a wonderful way, natural, doesn't feel forced at all. It feels like we cruise through her life in a way, get to know her, and it's beautiful. Beautiful.
Thank you.
The film is Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg, and we've been joined today by the co-directors, Alexis Bloom and Svetlana Zill. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.